Welcome to the Malefactors Register podcast. In this episode we begin a two-part exploration of murder and the supernatural with a pair of stories involving voodoo, witchcraft and spells. The first story involves a Maryland woman who almost got away with murder because the witnesses thought she was a voodoo queen. Our second tale takes place in Texas, where a witch served as a go-between in a murder-for-hire plot.
Voodoo Queen. Investigators using the most advanced scientific tools are sometimes no match for some of mankind's oldest fears and superstitions when it comes to solving crimes. Even at this time in history, when witchcraft trials have been out of vogue for more than 200 years, witnesses afraid of curses and spells are reluctant to tell police what they might know about a crime or criminal. Take for example the case of Josephine Gray, who was suspected of killing three men, but whom state authorities were never able to convict of murder. Maryland authorities could not get the murder charges to stick because witnesses were afraid to talk for fear of supernatural retribution from Gray. It took the federal government charging her with wire and mail fraud to finally bring Gray to justice. For years, Gray's relatives believed that she had gotten away with murdering two husbands and a young lover. The families of the men she killed were afraid to talk about what they thought, and Gray's family just didn't want to. Prosecutor Donald Gensler told the Washington Post in 2002 that there is a very unusual type of witness intimidation that had occurred in this case, which was the idea that Josephine Gray had the ability to practice black magic or witchcraft or voodoo. As irrational as that may seem to many people, it seemed rational to the family members and witnesses in this case. Not long after Gray's first husband, Norman Stribling, was gunned down while parked on a deserted road in Gaithersburg, Maryland in 1974, rumors began flying about her involvement. The couple married in 1967 and had five children together. Shortly before he was killed, Stribling discovered that his wife was having an affair with William Gray, who went by his middle name, Robert. Robert Gray and Josephine met while they were cleaning offices, and he eventually left his family to be with her. His family said later that after meeting Josephine, Robert underwent a profound personality change. According to his former wife, his whole demeanor just changed. He was distant, he stopped going around to his friends, his family, everybody. I knew something had to be wrong. This woman had so much hold over this man. Robert's wife said she heard rumors that Josephine was engaged in witchcraft or voodoo. While she rejected those claims, she did believe that Josephine was drugging Robert. She must have been feeding him something to make him do what she said, the woman told police. He wasn't himself. Robert's ex-wife said her suspicions were confirmed when Robert stopped eating food Josephine prepared and Robert returned to his old self. Around the time that Josephine and Robert were having their affair, Norman Stribling told family members that his life was in danger. How he justified those fears was not disclosed, but clearly Stribling was onto something. On March 3, 1974, he was found shot dead in his parked car on River Road in Montgomery County. He died from a single gunshot wound to the head and appeared to be the victim of a robbery. 2 weeks after Stribling was killed, Josephine and Robert were arrested for the crime. The case crumbled when family members, the only potential witnesses in what was a circumstantial case, refused to cooperate. Soon after she was released, Josephine made a claim on the $16,000 life insurance policy Stribling maintained with his wife as beneficiary. In August 1975, Josephine used most of the proceeds to buy a house with her fiancé, Robert Gray. 3 months later they were married. Robert Gray took out an insurance policy on his life that provided for payment of his mortgage on the Gaithersburg house in the event of his death, with any excess going to his wife. He also had another accidental death policy. Robert Gray's life with Josephine was a miserable life, his mother said. The marriage lasted until August 1990 when Robert left the house, telling family members that Gray was having an affair with her teenage cousin Clarence Good and that they wanted to kill him. A shy but troubled teen, Good had come to live with the Grays in the mid-1980s after Josephine promised his family that she would raise the boy right. In the summer of 1990, Josephine reportedly chased her husband through their house with a gun. He was only able to escape by jumping off a second-story balcony and running more than a mile to his parents' home. Robert was so afraid of Clarence and Josephine that he removed her as his beneficiary under the insurance policies and asked for help from friends and relatives for help in avoiding a possible attack by his wife and her lover. Later, Robert filed charges against Josephine and Clarence, alleging that Josephine had assaulted him at his workplace by swinging a baseball bat at him and lunging at him with a kitchen knife. Good, he alleged, threatened him with a 9mm pistol. The case came up for a hearing on October 5, 1990, but was continued by the court until November. That same day, Robert was driving home when he noticed his wife's car behind him. She was flashing her lights and signaling him to pull over, but he opted not to. Josephine drove alongside him, and as he looked over, he said he saw Clarence sit up from a reclining position and point a gun at him. They sped off. Robert reported this and a new warrant was sworn out against the pair. A week before the November 16th trial, Robert Gray was discovered dead in his apartment, shot in the chest and neck with a .45 caliber handgun. He had been surprised by his assailants because he had not even had time to remove his overcoat. Fear permeated this entire case, former prosecutor Thomas Tame told The Washington Post when Gray was indicted by the feds in 2002. In 1991, the state's case collapsed after Gray and a suspected accomplice were granted bail. There just was a marked difference in witness cooperation after she got out of jail, Tame told the Post. They were afraid she had gotten away with murder in the past, and how did they know she wasn't going to get away with murder again? Court documents from the federal case alleged that Gray intimidated potential witnesses and asked others to provide alibis. Her daughter with Robert Gray was one person asked to provide an alibi. At first she did so, saying that her mother was working when Robert was shot. She later recanted and said the alibi was false. However, when time came to testify before a grand jury, the girl said she could not remember anything about the day her father died. During the investigation into Robert's murder, Josephine was asked about voodoo and witchcraft. She denied being involved in either. "I do not practice no voodoo and I do not practice witchcraft," Josephine said in an interview with her attorneys. "Just because I go and buy a lucky charm to play the lottery or something, or buy herbs and drink herb tea or take olive oil and anoint myself, that's in the Bible." Relatives of Norman Stribling, Robert Gray and Clarence Good saw things differently. One of Stribling's family said he was under a magic spell that caused him uncontrollably to scratch his face to shreds. Good's sister reported finding a voodoo doll with real hair in his possessions. Evidence from her federal trial included an incantation caught on tape and voodoo ritual materials uncovered during a search of Josephine's home. By 1996, Clarence's relationship with Josephine soured and he moved out of her home after she threatened him with a knife. He also made the fatal error of allowing a $100,000 insurance policy with Josephine as the beneficiary lapse. The insurance company was still sending his mail to Josephine's house, and when she learned he was no longer paying the premiums but that the policy would remain in effect for 60 days, she decided to kill him. On June 21, 1996, Baltimore police found Clarence's body in the trunk of his car. He had been killed with a 9mm handgun. Before he vanished, Clarence told his sister that he was going to visit Josephine. A search of her house revealed 9mm bullets and a large stain on the garage floor that authorities thought was blood. Despite the evidence that was at least compelling outside of court, authorities could not move against Josephine for any murder, including Clarence's. There was no way to prove beyond a reasonable doubt in a court of law that she killed him, because her only real motive was that Clarence was her accomplice in another murder authorities could not prove. The case boiled down to the fact that a woman who was the beneficiary of her former live-in boyfriend's insurance policy happened to have the same kind of ammunition as that which killed him. It appeared that Josephine Gray was about to get away with her third murder. But in the summer of 2000, Wilma Jean Wilson met Josephine and they became friends. During one visit to Josephine's home, Wilma was helping clean a cluttered room when Josephine uncovered a scrapbook filled with newspaper articles about her previous arrests. According to court records, Josephine said she was going to tell Wilson something she had never told anyone before and she did not want Wilson to say anything about it. In an emotionless, matter-of-fact man, Gray then told Wilson that she had killed both her husbands and another gentleman. She said Stribling had to die because she was tired of being abused by him. She told me they had gone out for a ride and that she had shot him, Wilma testified. She left the body over on River Road, and it was set up to look like it was a robbery. Josephine then said that she killed Robert Gray with the help of Clarence Good and that Good had tried to blackmail her, so she had to get rid of him too. Josephine's motivation in confessing her crimes was not a guilty conscience. According to Wilma, she wanted Wilma's help in securing an insurance policy on her new boyfriend. Unaware of Josephine's reputation as a voodoo or witchcraft practitioner, or unafraid of it, Wilma approached authorities who began the wire fraud investigation against her. It is illegal to attempt to collect on an insurance policy of someone you have murdered and to use a telephone in furtherance of that crime. Federal authorities only had to establish to the satisfaction of the jury that Josephine had intentionally caused the deaths of the persons insured. They were able to do this once the witnesses lost their fear of her. A former boyfriend, the one that Josephine wanted to insure, testified that she told him she used the key she had to Robert Gray's townhouse to let herself in and waited for him. Josephine said she dressed like a man, wore a coat and gloves, and surprised Robert Gray when he walked in with a six-pack of beer. He did not report to authorities what Gray had said because he loved her. Josephine Gray was convicted of the insurance fraud charges and sentenced to 40 years in prison. A cure for the lovelorn. For Joey Fisher it was the best of times, it was the worst of times. It was the best of times because his graduation from Brownsville, Texas as exclusive St. Joseph School was rapidly approaching in the spring of 1993. College lay ahead of him, his future looked bright. It was the worst of times because he was involved in a bizarre and lingering breakup from his one-time girlfriend, Christina Cisneros, that seemed more like a battle with Christina's mother, Dora. Things had gotten so strained between the former sweethearts that there was talk of legal action to get back the senior class ring he gave to Christina. Dora promised to give him back his ring at a sit-down with Joey's father, but added that she wanted to make him sweat a bit before she did so. Everything had started off simply enough. Joey and Christina attended the same school and attended prom together. It seemed like just another high school romance that had ended when Joey's head was turned by another girl he met at a relative's wedding. But Christina, and to a much, much greater extent, Dora, did not want the relationship to end. First came the strange offer of $500 if Joey continued to date Christina. Next there were threatening phone calls from Dora to Joey. Then came the bizarre offering in the mailbox. Joey's mother came home to find an envelope with her name on it. Inside was a card with a skull and crossbones. The fixation was doubly irrational. First of all, it seemed like Dora, not Christina, was the driving force behind the anger, and second, Christina had no reason to doggedly pursue Joey. She was an intelligent, attractive, artistic young woman from an affluent family. Her father was a surgeon and her mother came from a family of bankers. Undoubtedly Christina would find love again. In fact, she already had begun dating another youth from school. Meanwhile, for Daniel Garza, aka Guru, it was definitely the worst of times. Garza was an unemployed house painter who moonlighted as a drug mule for the Dallas area Quayla drug ring. Around the time Joey Fisher and Christina Cisneros were getting ready for the prom, Garza and his wife were getting ready to separate. Garza was convinced that supernatural forces were at work to ruin his marriage. "I had always suspected that my wife's mother and aunts had worked through a curandera in San Antonio, Texas to put a bad spell, witchcraft, on my wife and I to separate," he wrote in a confession to police. "My mother-in-law, deceased, never did like me." Curandera translates roughly from Spanish as witch or healer. Convinced that it takes a witch to fight a witch, Garza, during a June 1992 visit to his sister in Matamoros, decided to visit a curandera across the Rio Grande in Brownsville for advice. The curandera, Maria Mercedes Martinez, operated out of a second-hand clothing store, reading cards, telling fortunes, and selling healing herbs and oils. Over the next several months, Martinez counseled Garza and promised that with her help he could repair his personal life. Martinez had another client who was equally troubled over a relationship. It was Dora Cisneros. In the fall of 1992, Dora visited her longtime curandera seeking a divination. It was about a problem she had with her daughter, Martinez later testified. "She wanted me to read the cards to find out if the boyfriend of her daughter would marry her. I was reading the cards and told her that he didn't want to marry her anymore." The news seriously angered Dora, and several days later she returned to Martinez and asked that the curandera cast a spell on Joey, which Martinez refused to do. Following up, Dora asked if Martinez could find someone who could do a little job for her, Martinez said. Martinez thought of another client, Daniel Garza. "In December 1992, I visited La Curandera Martinez at her store. It was on that visit that she told me about a woman she called La Clienta that needed to have a guy beaten up," Garza told police. "La Clienta would pay up to $3,500. She told me to help her with that, and in return she would guarantee me that everything would be alright with my personal problems." Although Christina would later deny on the witness stand that she and Joey had been intimate, Garza said that he was told Joey had sexually violated La Clienta's daughter and was talking about her at school to other students. Sometime after Christmas 1992, Dora decided that a beating wasn't sufficient for the boy who jilted her daughter. She told Martinez that she wanted Joey killed. Dora and Garza never spoke with each other, but both were putting pressure on Martinez. Dora adamantly wanted Martinez to find someone to kill Joey, while Garza wanted Martinez to do something to repair his marriage, which by this time had already ended in divorce. Martinez pushed back on Garza. While Garza was talking by phone with La Curandera Martinez, she would frequently steer the conversation back to La Clienta Dora's problem. Several times during their talks, Garza falsely told La Curandera that he had found someone to take care of Joey, and for a few minutes the discussion would center on Dora's problem rather than Garza's. "It was during the month of January 1993 that I returned to Brownsville to see La Curandera again because I had paid her lots of money and nothing had changed in my life. Instead I had gotten a divorce," he confessed. "She again asked me if I had talked to anyone or gotten anyone to kill the guy. She again guaranteed me that my luck would change if I helped her with this offer." It's an understatement in light of this story to say that love makes people do strange things, but believing that harming Joey would repair his own love life, Garza did a strange thing. He reached out through his drug connections and contacted a pair of Mexican hitmen, Israel Olivares and Heriberto Pizana. On Valentine's Day 1993, Garza met with Olivares and Pizana and gave them a picture of Joey in his prom tuxedo. On the back of the photo was Fisher's address. The killers promised to take care of the job the next time they were in Brownsville. On the morning of March 3, 1993, Joey Fisher was preparing to go to school with his sister and brother and was in the driveway cleaning the windshield of his mother's car. His stepfather, Vernon Nelson, later testified that he was inside his home with Joey's mother when they heard a pair of loud pops. Corrine Nelson went outside to investigate. I heard her scream. Just a blood-chilling scream. Nelson testified. I saw Joey was laying down in the driveway in a pool of blood and Corrine was down to help him and she was screaming. Joey had been shot twice in the head. Next to him on the ground lay one of the few clues police would have to track his killers, a bloody business card belonging to a Dallas bail bondsman. A single unidentifiable athletic shoe print was found near the driveway. The only other evidence police had to go on was an eyewitness description of the apparent getaway car, a white four-door vehicle with Mexican plates. Shortly after the murder, Olivares called Garza to let him know Joey was dead.
You're a star. Dame la feria. It's done. Give me the money.
Garza recalled the gunman saying. I told him I didn't have it with me, that I needed to get it, Garza told the cops. He added that he then contacted Martinez, who then called Dora Cisneros. Oh yes, 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 Martinez said. Dora excitedly babbled over the phone. I'll be right over. Sometime before noon, Dora delivered an envelope containing 35 $100 bills to Martinez, who alerted Garza that the payoff had been delivered. It was around 12 p.m. when I got to Martinez's store. Her television set was on Channel 4 News. That's when I saw the news on the murder at Rancho Viejo Country Club. La Curandera Martinez gave me a white bank envelope with the money, which contained $3,500. Investigators quickly traced the bail bondsman's card to the Rudy Cuellar drug gang based on handwriting on the back of the card. Cuellar had used the firm to post bail when he was arrested on a domestic violence charge. Dogged but routine flat-footed detective work eventually turned up the fact that Garza, an own associate of Cuellar, had purchased a .38-caliber superautomatic pistol from a gun shop in February 1993. A superautomatic was used to kill Joey. Garza's gun was reported stolen after Joey's murder, and the murder weapon was never found. It did not take police long to arrest Garza for his role in the murder. The shooters, however, were long gone over the Mexican border. In an effort to avoid a needle in his arm for participating in a murder-for-hire scheme, Garza began cooperating with authorities. While wearing a wire, he twice contacted Martinez, telling her that the killers wanted more money. Both times Martinez gave him an additional $500. Repeating the trick, police arrested La Curandera and convinced the 70-year-old woman to wear a wire to trap Dora Cisneros. Driving around Brownsville in her Cadillac, Dora delivered $500 cash to Martinez and questioned whether the murder of Joey Fisher could be linked to her. There isn't any evidence that I did anything, Dora asked in Spanish. Shortly after Dora asks if she can be tied to the murder, the tape reveals the sound of police sirens and records the arrest of Dora Cisneros. At the time, April 7, 1993, it appeared that the authorities had made the best of a terrible situation. They had quickly wrapped up a bizarre and tragic murder plot and had solid evidence against everyone involved. Little did anyone know that the worst was yet to come. Dora went to trial in February 1994, on capital murder charges. Most of the evidence against her came from Martinez. Garza was on trial with her. The case in chief against the pair was the testimony of the septuagenarian Martinez, who pleaded guilty to second-degree murder in exchange for a 2 to 20-year prison term. On the stand, La Curandera detailed how Cisneros repeatedly pressured her into finding someone who would kill Joey and how she eventually convinced the reluctant Garza to help her. It appeared to be an open and shut case against Dora. Martinez's testimony was corroborated by circumstantial evidence that Dora had cashed in a certificate of deposit to raise the $3,500 to pay the killers, as well Dora's behavior after the relationship between Joey and her daughter faltered. Finally, there was tape-recorded conversations between Martinez and Dora where the vengeful mother questioned her advisor whether or not the murder could be traced back to her. After a brief trial, Dora Cisneros and Daniel Garza were convicted of murder. Each received a life term. The case disappeared from the front pages and TV screens for less than 2 years until Brownsville was shaken by the decision of the Texas Court of Appeals that not only tossed Dora's conviction, but ruled that double jeopardy applied and that she could not be tried again. Essentially, the court allowed Dora Cisneros, whom everyone knew was guilty of sin, to get away with murder thanks to a rookie mistake by prosecutors who drafted the indictment. It all boiled down to how the jury was instructed to consider the charges. In her appeal, Dora contended that the evidence was insufficient to prove that she employed Olivares or Pisana to murder Joey, and that Olivares or Pisana in fact murdered him. Viewed most favorably to the verdict, the evidence shows that Dora got Martinez to seek out someone to kill Fisher, and that Martinez turned to Garza to find someone to do the killing, the appeals court wrote. There is sufficient evidence to show that Dora gave envelopes of money, directions, and information to Martinez to pass on to Garza, and that Fisher was killed by gunshots fired from the same type of weapon purchased by Garza. The evidence that was admitted does not support a finding that Dora either employed Pisana or Olivares, or that Pisana or Olivares murdered Fisher. When closely analyzed, the jury was instructed that unless they found that Olivares or Pisana murdered Joey, they could not convict Dora. The record clearly shows that there was simply no evidence admitted against Dora to establish that Olivares killed Fisher, the judges wrote. As for Pisana, there are some suspicious facts regarding his involvement, but none rise to the level of beyond a reasonable doubt. Furthermore, the jury was instructed that unless they found that Dora employed Israel Olivares or Heriberto Pisana to murder Fisher, they could not convict her of capital murder. We find the evidence insufficient to show that appellant herself employed Olivares and Pisana to kill Fisher. In January 1996, Dora Cisneros walked out of prison a free woman. Not surprisingly, the reaction from most people was anger and frustration. Joey's father was furious. She was convicted on the evidence, and she is being acquitted on paperwork, a paperwork technicality, he said. And I think it's ridiculous. Dora Cisneros' attorney acknowledged that the decision did hinge on a trial blunder by the district attorney. But a victory is a victory, he said. We won, it's over with, says Tony Canales. But Canales' declaration was premature, and at least in Joey Fisher's case, the scales of justice just took a little longer to balance out. In 1998, the federal government stepped in and picked up a case. A little less than 5 years after Joey Fisher was murdered, FBI agents arrested Dora at her Brownsville home after she was indicted for using an interstate communications device, aka a telephone, in furtherance of the murder-for-hire plot. After a week-long trial that differed little from the state trial, Dora Cisneros was convicted of using the telephone to arrange for Joey's murder. The judge handed down a life sentence. Dora appealed again, arguing that there was insufficient evidence that she used the telephone in furtherance of the conspiracy. Eventually, the United States Court of Appeals ruled that it didn't matter how much Dora used the phone, the fact that she caused Garza through Martinez to engage in the use of the phone and travel for an act that resulted in murder made her as guilty as the men who pulled the trigger. Dora Cisneros continues to serve her life term in a federal prison.
We hope you have enjoyed this podcast of the Malefactors Register. For more true crime stories, visit the Register online at markgribben.com. These stories were written by Mark Gribben and read by Peter Gray. This podcast was produced by Jeffrey Barnes. I'm Rachel Johnson. This podcast is copyright 2011 and may not be rebroadcast without permission of the copyright holder. The Malefactors Register podcasts are available on iTunes. Until next time, goodbye.